Everest Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Talks at the UN on a new treaty banning nuclear weapons got underway Monday. Kim Wong-soo is the UN Undersecretary and High Representative for Disarmament Affairs.
This conference is taking place against a backdrop of rising international tensions, renewed arms competition, and an absence of results in disarmament bodies.
Supporters insist little progress has been made in recent years to get rid of such weapons, but nearly 40 countries, including the U.S., said they will not take part. They renewed their commitment to the nearly 50-year-old nuclear nonproliferation treaty. Nikki Haley is the U.S. UN ambassador.
There is nothing I want more for my family than a world with no nuclear weapons. But we have to be realistic. Is there anyone that believes that North Korea would agree to a ban on nuclear weapons? So what you would see is the General Assembly would go through in good faith trying to do something, but North Korea would be the one cheering, and all of us and the people we represent would be the ones at risk.
The UN General Assembly adopted a resolution in December to negotiate a legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading to their total elimination. At least 31 Islamist al-Shabaab insurgents were killed by Kenyan troops in a raid on two bases in the southern Somali region of Jubaland. A Kenyan Defense Forces statement Monday said ground troops were backed up by attack helicopters and artillery fire. The raid took place Sunday. The Kenyans also said they captured arms, communications equipment, and uniforms. Militants insist no raid took place. Kenya, part of the African Union force to fight the counterinsurgency group. This is VOA News. The U.S. Monday condemned the detention of hundreds of anti-corruption protesters in Russia Sunday. Thousands turned out in dozens of cities in some of the largest protests seen in years. Sean Spicer is a White House spokesman.
The United States strongly condemns the detention of hundreds of peaceful protesters throughout Russia on Sunday. The detention of peaceful protesters, human rights observers, and journalists is an affront to essential democratic values. We are troubled to hear of the arrest of the opposition leader upon arrival at the demonstration, as well as the police raids on the anti-corruption organization he heads. The United States will monitor the situation, and we call on the government of Russia to immediately release all peaceful protesters.
A Russian court Monday sentenced opposition leader and anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny to 15 days in jail and for resisting police, and penalized him with a fine for organizing what authorities said was an illegal mass protest in Moscow. Navalny rejected the claim, insisting that as long as people see funds being kidnapped by high-ranking officials and a complete lack of answers, they will keep taking to the streets. His lawyer plans to appeal. Iraqi forces Monday launched new assaults against Islamic State's stronghold in Mosul's Old City. A police statement said federal police and rapid response units started their advance toward the Al-Nouri Mosque area Monday. Meanwhile, U.S. defense officials are reviewing video of coalition airstrikes to determine whether it was responsible for the deaths of up to 200 civilians last week, a large explosion leveled part of western Mosul on March 17th. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions Monday announced the Justice Department would withhold funding from local jurisdictions that don't comply with federal immigration law. Sessions said sanctuary jurisdictions endanger the lives of Americans and put the whole community at risk.
Unfortunately, some states and cities have adopted policies designed to frustrate this enforcement of immigration laws. This includes refusing to detain known felons under federal detainer requests or otherwise failing to comply with these laws.
So-called sanctuary communities help illegal immigrants avoid deportation. At least 10 people killed Monday in a suicide bombing and gun attack by jihadists, suspected of being affiliated with Al-Qaeda, on local government compound in the southern Yemeni town of Al-Houta. The Tanzanian government ordered the release of a popular local musician a day after he was arrested for allegedly poking fun at the government in a song. Police charged Ney Wa Mtego for showing disrespect for the presidency in a newly released Swahili rap song. U.S. stocks fell again Monday in the wake of Congress's inability to pass health insurance reform. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor says Mr. Taylor is not trying to meddle in Liberia's 2017 presidential election.
Former President Taylor is in jail for 50 years. He's barely able to pay for his meals and his telephone calls. Where is he going to get the money to fund anyone?
Joa Howard Taylor is the ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor and also a vice presidential candidate in this year's elections. Unyala University in Sierra Leone is expected to reopen today, months after it was shut down due to lecturer strike. And the new African Union Commission chairperson is concerned about the lack of peace implementation in South Sudan.
Comme je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, manifestement, l'accord...
The agreement exists, but it is not being implemented. At least it has difficulties in being implemented.
Moussa Faki Mahamat is Chad's former foreign minister and the new AU Commission chairperson, speaking through an interpreter. And experts say climate change may make Africa's drought worse. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor says Mr. Taylor is not trying to meddle in Liberia's 2017 presidential election. Joa Howard Taylor, who has two children by Mr. Taylor, also denies her former husband might be funneling money to support former football star George Weah's third presidential bid this year. In January this year, Weah chose Mrs. Howard Taylor as his vice presidential running mate in this year's Liberian elections. In late January, Mr. Taylor called his supporters from prison on his 69th birthday and urged them to what he called return to base. Also, Weah admitted this month that he had spoken by phone with Mr. Taylor. Howard Taylor says her former husband has no money and is barely able to pay for his meals in prison, and his lawyers did pro bono work. She says her former husband calling his supporters was his way of encouraging them to look to the future.
When you said meddling, and I know that's a question that is on the minds of many people outside of Liberia, I don't know what meddling means. The issue of former President Taylor calling to speak to ex-combatants maybe was his way of giving them some direction as to, hey, this is about Liberia. And if you heard the entire clip, he even talked about the fact that in spite of what had happened between him, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but I heard him say in that tape that in spite of what had happened, that he forgives her and that everybody should forgive her so that we can move our country forward. Nobody's talking about that. People are just raising the issue of old President Taylor called. He actually prayed for Liberia. He prayed for the for successful elections so that the country can now move to the level that we all hope. And so I don't think that's a negative.
So Mr. Taylor is not funding your campaign or George Weah's campaign?
Of course not. Former President Taylor is in jail for 50 years. He's barely able to pay for his meals and his telephone calls. Where is he going to get the money to fund anyone? And, you know, during the trial, that was a byword that he had stolen millions of dollars out of Liberia's coffers, and he had them somewhere. I'm still waiting for someone to bring me the proof of the money that Charles Taylor had. We had to get pro bono services for the lawyers who took care of him. So he's not funding any process. He doesn't have the capacity to fund the process. But for me, I want to state here categorically that we're moving forward. It's about Liberia. It's about the thousands of young people who have no opportunities. It's about the women who are now concerned about whether their issues will be put on the back burner. It's about women who want to take part in these elections so that they can contribute their quota to the society. What do we do to bring a mix together that each of the aspects of our country and its population segments will feel apart? And that is what we are concerned about.
Talking about Ambassador George Weah, people say to me that he's kind of being muted, that he has not spoken in recent times. So what happened? Where is he?
And you know, when you have some people who don't care about a particular person, they will always find reasons to make that person look less than what they are. But I want to tell you, James, Ambassador George Weah is a patriot. He has shown that even during the crisis, when many of our so-called erudite states people were involved in the process of bringing war to Liberia, he was one of those carrying the Liberian flag and saying to people, my country is in crisis. We're having war. Our people are being displaced. What can you do to help? So he's shown patriotism even at a point when nobody wanted to talk about Liberia. And people see him as a common footballer. Is George Weah a common footballer? I say no. For someone as experienced as me to say yes, I'm willing to stand with him to transform our country, what do I see? There are some important aspects of his life that we bring to the table. George Weah is a team player. If he wasn't, he wouldn't have been selected as world best, Europe best, Africa best, in a sport at that time that was purely white dominated. How did a young black male from Nukutown in Monrovia rise to that level? He had some skills. He was a team player. He was someone who had vision, that he worked that vision through to become the great person that he is today. He also knows that to run Liberia needs a team of persons. The last 12 years, James has proven to me that the next leadership for our country should not be a one-man show or a one-woman show.
Senator Taylor, this is George Weah's third time running for president of Liberia. Does he feel that this time he's going to win, or this is his time?
I think this is our time. And maybe in 2005, it was about George Weah being president. In 2011, it was about Winston Tubman being president. In 2017, it is about George Weah bringing together a team of Liberians that can take our country to the next level. That's why I believe we have the right formula. We have a caliber of patriotic Liberians that have gone through the last 30 years and that have the zeal and the desire to put in place a new country so that the young people see Liberia as it should be.
Jewel Howard Taylor is the ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor. She spoke with me in our Washington studio. Tomorrow, Mrs. Taylor will discuss how she and her running mate George Weah hope to improve Liberia's economy if they are elected in this year's presidential election. Unjayala University in Sierra Leone is expected to reopen today, Tuesday, nearly a week after protests in three cities resulted in the death of one person and several others wounded. The students were protesting the continued closure of their university due to a four-month-long lecturer strike over payment of outstanding allowances. The police accused the students of engaging in violent acts. Yesterday, a judge found three Unjayala students guilty of disrupting traffic and disorderly behavior and sentenced them to 3 years in prison. Michael Mitchell is the public relations officer for the National Union of Sierra Leone Students. He says the students were given suspended sentences if they could pay an estimated $110 each.
You can recall that on the 23rd of March, the students decided to express their frustration. For us, I always maintain that the call for them to have actually expressed their frustration like that was legitimate. But because the police thought they were executing their own duty as a law enforcement agency, we are able to release about more than 15 to 20. But there were 14 others plus two other people who are also currently in detention, also being charged. So the following day, the matter was sent to court and there was a decision by the magistrate, the presiding magistrate. His judgment was that 14 of the students were guilty of three count charges. And the three count charges were sentenced to 3 months imprisonment or a fine of 850,000 leone each, is about $109 to $10, which means the 14 of them, a cumulative sum of 11,900,000, that around $1,600 approximately though. So yes, they were being charged and they were being sentenced to 3 months imprisonment or paying a fine, cumulative 14 of them of about $1,600. We, as a union, National Union of Sierra Leone Students, did on that day try to set up a team to galvanize funds to urgently for that particular sentence. And thankfully, they are not in prison. They are gradually coping up, and we're hoping that they join their colleagues as they resume.
So are you saying that Unjayala University, the campuses are being reopened?
Yeah, maybe as a swift update, after the strike, or should you say coincidentally, because that's what the university, because which is the highest structural body of the university, said it was coincidental. they had a meeting, and the resolution of the meeting was to encourage the academic staff who were on strike to call off the strike on that particular day. The following day, however, the academic staff pulled out a press release saying that they are calling off, they are suspending the strike, contingent on two things, which are one, that their demands are met almost immediately, and two, that an investigation be done into the administration of Jala. Well, it seems like there is a seemingly mistrust between both parties, or one is accusing one another of maybe mismanagement of funds and things like that.
So can we say that Unjala University will reopen on Tuesday?
Yes, that's our expectation, and that's what actually all of the parties have agreed on, and that's our hope, and we're hoping that it reopens on the 28th of March.
Michael Mitchell is the public relations officer for the National Union of Sierra Leone Students. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 28th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The new chair of the African Union Commission says he's concerned about the failure of South Sudan stakeholders to implement the peace agreement. Moussa Faki Mahamad, who visited South Sudan over the weekend, called on regional and international partners to take additional measures to spur implementation of the deal. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Former Foreign Minister of Chad, Moussa Faki Mahamad, is paying a visit to Juba for the first time since being chosen by the 54-member body to run the AU in late January. He arrived Saturday and traveled to Ganiel, one of the areas in former Unity State hardest hit by the more than three-year-long conflict. Speaking in French, Mahamad says he is frustrated that implementation of the South Sudan Peace Agreement has been stalled for so long.
Comme je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, manifestement, l'accord...
The agreement exists, but it is not being implemented. At least it has difficulties in being implemented. The international community as a whole, and particularly the African Union, is trying to do everything so that it can help South Sudan to implement this agreement.
Mahamad did not elaborate on what measures the AU is taking to speed up implementation of the agreement. He says fighting between warring parties continues to exacerbate the efforts to help South Sudanese suffering from hunger and physical abuse. Mahamad describes what he saw in Ganiel.
Mon impression quand j'ai visité le terrain est qu'il y a des populations qui souffrent.
People are suffering. People are suffering from famine. Women and children are victims. And there can be two causes only to the famine. One is the natural phenomenon, that is, you can have natural causes, that is, you can have drought and therefore you have famine. But the other one is also peace and security element, which is one of the main issues which can worsen the situation that prevails in the country.
Mahamad reminded signatories to the peace agreement that they are the primary implementers of the deal and must abide by the ceasefire and all other aspects of the agreement. South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister Elia Lomuro claims the Kiir administration is doing all it can to implement the agreement, but says its hands are tight regarding certain parts of the deal.
So we are hammering in and saying to the people who signed the agreement that we have done everything possible, but financially we are not able to finance fully, particularly Chapter 2. We are going to pay money from April, but it will not be enough to do everything that is necessary to implement Chapter 2.
Chapter 2 of the deal refers to reforms in the national security sector. Specifically, it requires that rebel forces belonging to the SPLM-A in opposition are integrated to the national army. It also requires that the international community help fund some of those reforms. Lomuro says unless there is a major breakthrough regarding implementation of Chapter 2, little can be achieved on other parts of the deal.
And if you don't reform the security sector, I can tell you the other chapters of the agreement have no meaning.
It has been 19 months since the peace agreement was signed by the warring parties. Very little progress has been achieved since that time. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The International Conference for Great Lakes Region and the East African Community are set to cooperate for the first time on economic and security concerns in the Great Lakes region. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
The East African Community is made up of six African countries, while the International Conference for the Great Lakes region has 12 member countries, including six from East Africa. In December 2010, both organizations signed a Memorandum of Understanding on joint interventions regarding refugees and humanitarian issues, as well as promotion of democracy and good governance. However, nothing tangible has ever been accomplished. East African Community Secretary General Liberan Fomukeko says there is a need to revive and implement the memorandum.
Our sitting today may not have come at a better time. The current economic circumstances in the region, the security and environmental concerns coupled with the fluid global political dispensation makes it imperative for the ICGLR to take its rightful place as provided for in Article 26 of the Pact on Security, Stability and Development in the Great Lakes region, to which all EAC partner states are party.
The two African regional blocs are meeting in Bujumbura for a technical meeting to tackle the challenges that the 12 African countries are facing. Muita Muburi is the executive secretary of the Great Lakes Organization.
Moment for us as the ICGLR Secretariat welcoming the Secretary General of the East African Community is to work on the individual mandates, to get a confluence of the individual mandates of the two organizations so as to advance the cause of peace and security as well as development. Whereas we work more for political intervention to end the conflict and the insecurity situations in the region.
One of the major concerns in the region is the deteriorating relations between Burundi and Rwanda. Problems began in April 2015 when Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek for another term in the office, something the opposition called unconstitutional. East African Community Secretary General Liberan Fumukeko comments on the situation.
I mean, the situation between Burundi and Rwanda, I think, may be improving. At the EAC level, this is an issue which has been actually dealt with at the highest level, with the summit of heads of states. So I know that for sure that our presidents have been approaching the two countries at the highest level and trying to get them together. So the latest discussions I had on this matter are very optimistic.
The technical meetings are expected to come up with frameworks not only to tackle the refugee crisis and political intervention, but also to discourage the illegal exploitation of the region's natural resources. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
As East Africa struggles through a drought, scientists say climate change may be making the situation worse. VOA Steve Baragona looks at how a warming planet may be altering the weather patterns that bring rain to the region.
The rains failed late last year, and the rains before that were meager. Livestock have died. Crops have failed. Famine threatens Somalia for the second time this decade. While drought is not uncommon in this dry region, it's gotten worse, says University of California at Santa Barbara climate scientist Chris Funk.
Yeah, so what we've seen over the last, say, 35 years is that the rainfall during the what's called the long rains has declined substantially.
Funk says the explanation may lie in an atmospheric cycle that links East Africa and the Pacific Ocean. Warm, wet air rises over the Western Pacific, causing rain over Southeast Asia. On the other side of the cycle, dry air descends over East Africa. That's why not much rain falls here, even in normal years. But when the Western Pacific is warmer, it pushes the whole system harder. More rain over Southeast Asia and more dry air descending on East Africa. More dry air means more drought. And Chris Funk says the ocean is getting warmer.
The warming over the Western Pacific, you know, appears to be, you know, pretty much directly related to increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Research shows that in the past, a warmer planet meant a drier East Africa. But Funk says it's not entirely clear whether the current drying trend will continue.
You know, one of the things making it hard to look into the future is the fact that the story told by the global climate models, the climate change models, is pretty much exactly the opposite of what we're seeing in East Africa.
The models say it should be getting wetter, but experts increasingly think the models may be flawed in this area. Funk and others are working on it. The short term is more clear. The Western Pacific is still warmer than average, which means the forecast is for a third season of disappointing rains. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Doctors at a Chicago area hospital here in the United States have successfully operated on a baby from Africa born with a parasitic twin and having four legs and two spines. The girl, known only as Dominique from Ivory Coast, is recovering well from the delicate and groundbreaking March 8th surgery and is expected to live a normal, fully functional life. VOA's Bronwyn Benito reports.
Baby Dominique was born with four legs and two spines. Her identical twin had failed to separate, leaving a large mass of legs and feet connected to her.
As if the twin, from the waist down, had been attached to the back of Dominique's neck. And there was a pelvis and bladder and functional legs that moved and feet coming out of the back of Dominique's neck.
The parasitic twin was causing 10-month-old Dominique's little heart and lungs to work overtime to support the equivalent of two bodies. The extra weight on her neck threw off her balance, impeding normal growth and development. The extra body parts were attached to Dominique's spinal cord and nervous system, making surgery to remove them delicate. So doctors at Advocate Children's Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois, used scans and imaging to create a three-dimensional model of her two spines.
We had an enormous amount of specialized imaging that would allow us to identify her own native anatomy, the anatomy of the parasitic twin, and anticipate the problems we might see so that we could minimize any opportunity for a surprise during surgery.
Once in the operating room, Vicari says the critical part of the surgery involved the junction at the base of the two spines and the abnormal pelvis.
And once we had control of that, I think it was pretty clear to most people in the operating room that we were going to actually successfully be able to accomplish the surgery.
The surgery, performed March 8th, lasted 6 hours. Dominique was able to sit up the next day and was released for recovery 5 days later into the care of a local foster family. Doctors believe Dominique has a long and productive life ahead. She will be reunited with her family in Ivory Coast following her recovery period, most likely next month. Bronwyn Benito, VOA News, Washington.
And briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor says Mr. Taylor, who is serving a 50-year jail sentence for war crimes, is not trying to meddle in Liberia's 2017 presidential election. Jua Howard Taylor, who has two children by Mr. Taylor, also denies her former husband might be funneling money to support former football star George Weah's third presidential bid this year. In January this year, Weah chose Mrs. Howard Taylor as his vice presidential running mate in this year's Liberian elections. Jua Howard Taylor says her former husband calling his supporters from his jail was his way of encouraging them to look to the future. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our sports editor Samson O'Malley, all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very nice day.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Salee. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, 20 million people are suffering from a hunger crisis. An in-depth discussion on the international call for action on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.